I love it when people come here to this new place that we've created, but they walk in and they say, oh, it just feels right. It feels like it's been here. It feels old. It feels like it's landed in the right place. And I love how comfortable people feel at this place.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. There are many that have created restaurants or cafes that have become the hub of the community. Others have forged connections with local growers, farmers, and makers to celebrate the best of the region and support small artisan businesses. And there are some that have embraced both to change the perceptions of food production for a large part of the population of a big city and deliver delicious, nutritious food too. Angela Hurst is the founder and owner of The Wandering Cooks in Brisbane, Queensland. Angela, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm good. You started initially with a gathering of food trucks sort of strung together with extension leads everywhere and built this amazing thing called The Wandering Cooks. Where did the idea come from?
The idea for Wandering Cooks started when I was trying to get my own food business ideas off the ground. And I started to realize as I was doing that I couldn't understand how anyone could afford it. And also how anyone could take the kind of risks that you have to take to be able to invest, even if you couldn't afford it, to start these food businesses. So I really didn't know what I was doing. And so I started a business for people that don't know what they're doing. There's various details to that. But basically, I thought, if I could create a series of kitchens that people could rent to try out their food business ideas, that they'd be able to be more creative, they'd be able to be more responsive to the possibilities of, thinking outside the box with their food business without having to, like, put their house on the line to do it. And one of the things that was the foundational to that for me is that if I could get small producers, people with big ideas, but just starting off, to start to think about where they source their food from when they're right at the beginning of their business, that maybe we could actually be quite impactful as far as the way that food businesses link to the places that produce their food and the farmers that produce their food. So it's it was a crazy idea. It was a pretty big idea in Australia. No one else was doing it in Australia. There was a history of it happening in the States. There's quite a few for about 5 years previous. There were quite a few people that had been setting up commissary kitchens for food trucks and kitchens for small artisan businesses, but nothing in Australia. And I did it because I was a passionate food maker, and I let my production of food, I put that to the side so that I could support other people to do it. And that was, that was partly about where I was at in my life. I had a 2-year-old, and I couldn't see how I could, work the kind of shifts that hospitality requires of you. So yeah, supporting small food makers seemed like a good idea.
What was it like in those early days? Do you have any stories of the challenges at that time?
Well, it was, I was pretty clear about where I wanted this business to be. I wanted it to be really centrally located, and it needed to have a series of facilities around it. So it needed, people needed to be able to drive up to it. They needed to be able to park. Trucks needed to be able to load. It required a bit of space. And in those days, so that was 9 years ago now, Brisbane was right on the edge of quite a boom in medium density housing. So everywhere that we looked was had a new zoning. So there were all these beautiful old warehouses that would have been perfect for Cooks to land in. But, you know, there was no way that they would give us the kind of lease that we needed to be able to invest in the site. You know, they'd say, you know, you can have 3 years, you know, in second option, having a demolition clause on it and things like that. So it was a year of looking at warehouses, pretty much faced with that. And also it was just after the floods, the Brisbane floods. So there was a lot of warehouses that were actually under the flood line as well. Then we finally found this place on Fish Lane, and the landlord really didn't, it was an inherited property. He really didn't want to see it go, you know, disappear. And he just gave us a lease situation that was, it was like being, you know, handed a unicorn. You know, we had what seemed like at the time a lot of time. We had 5 years with an option for another five. A demolition clause wouldn't hit in until the second lease, and we'd have 2 years' notice, you know, before we'd have to leave. So it seemed reasonable enough to invest in building these kitchens, and then had to scrape together the money. And that was a challenge, and went into a lot of debt. And but I, you know, I'd done a lot of research, and I'd done a lot of work in spreadsheets, and I'd pulled together, you know, a lot of interest in the place. You know, I'd put up these Gumtree ads and say, hey, anyone got a business idea but no kitchen? Who'd want to join us? You know, and oh my God, I had like, I don't know, after the first outreach from me, I think I had like 160 different people that wanted it. But then I opened the doors, and guess what? No one, like maybe like two or three people ended up kind of coming into the kitchens. That was the biggest first learning curve, was that just because people say they're going to do something doesn't mean they're actually going to put their money behind it. So yeah, from the beginning, I was spinning my wheels. So that brings us back to food trucks. So spinning my wheels, desperately trying to actually fill these kitchens, realizing that, you know, although people were supposed to be using commercial kitchens, the regulations weren't really tight enough to actually require them to. So, you know, they might, you know, book into the kitchens, but really not use them very much. And I just started to realize that we had to diversify. We had to look towards other revenue streams. And that's when that was the beginning of us becoming an event space as well as a set of kitchens. So
what were some of the food businesses to flourish in that sort of first part of the business sort of unfolding?
One of the first businesses to call me were these two sisters, and they were just, you know, wanting to do baked things, selling at markets. That was, you know, a lot of people were headed in that direction. I want to bake something. I'm going to sell at the markets. But they really did have they had a twist on their stuff that you didn't see around, like. At that time, you know, a little bit trashy American, but, you know, in that, you know, tasty, trashy American kind of milk bar thing going on with their stuff. And also they were immediately really receptive to sourcing their ingredients through some more careful channels. So, you know, getting good eggs and getting good butter and all of that, they were just up for. They were called the Alphabet Cafe. So they had this, you know, hope in their business name that they would, you know, eventually become a cafe. And they just did anything, any crazy idea that we had going. So, you know, they were baking, they started wholesaling, and they were selling at the markets. And then when we started inviting the food trucks to park, so this was before food trucks tried to take off in Brisbane, there was nowhere for them to park privately on private land, and they were only allowed to sell on private land. So at that stage, there was no ability for a truck to park on a public street. So we opened our car park up to food trucks, and we set up bin fires in the middle of the car park and pulled out tables, and the Alphabet Girls would toast their homemade marshmallows on the fire and make s'mores in the middle of the car park. They were awesome. So they were there from the very beginning. They were there, and like maybe 3 years before we had to move, they managed to open their own cafe, and they've got a really beautiful cafe in West End, and yeah, they're killing it.
When was the moment that you realized the potential had sort of eventuated with the Wandering Cooks, and there was real momentum behind what you were doing?
Probably the momentum came when I gave up trying to make money on the kitchens. So I thought that they would be the main revenue generator, and it just didn't work that way. Like, people could not afford the prices that they were worth, basically, like with the equipment that was in them and the capital we'd put into them. They couldn't afford the hourly rates that you'd see other places set up for, you know, professional for companies that are launching products, and they're doing research and those kinds of kitchens. You know, they charge thousands of dollars a day, you know, for using commercial kitchens. Well, clearly we were having trouble getting people to pay $25 an hour. So I got to a point where I put it all out. And I gathered together the customers that I had and said to them, look, I'm gonna reduce the prices of the kitchens down to something that makes it really easy for you to really work on your business, but you gotta promise me, well, not just promise me, I'm gonna change the way I book them so that the hours that you, the minimum hours are longer, and if this doesn't work and you guys don't commit to like periods of time, like, you know, you got to commit to your business, you got to commit to it for 6 months. If you can't commit to those time periods, then I'm going to have to close these kitchens. I'm going to go out of business. So I started to stabilize that, and then just focused on events. So we became the place that would say yes to any kind of community focused event. So a lot of the people that had interesting ideas for exhibitions or festivals or fundraising events, panel discussions on various issues, any of those kinds of people, we wouldn't charge them again. We wouldn't charge them, but we would make money on the bar. We'd make money on the booze, and we focused on revenue through our bar. So, I mean, I made a lot of potentially unconventional decisions along the way about the things that I wasn't going to make money on, in order to focus on the things that I thought we could make money on, which ended up being the bar. And I still look at it and think, could I have done it? Would there have been an easier way? Could I have done it differently? But at the time, yeah, I mean, you just can't force people to do things they don't want to do, right? And if they don't want to cook their cookies in a kitchen, if they want to do it illegally at home, if they want to run their catering business from their home, and then they just will until they get caught, right? Anyway. So that, yeah. So it, yeah. The pivotal moment was getting into events, turning into a bar, and then there was a switch that happened from really allowing product manufacturers anytime they've liked in the kitchen, you know, across the schedule, to focusing on getting a series of people that wanted to actually make food for our venue to set up during food service hours. So we moved from product makers having their freedom. And at that point, when the kitchens were really cheap and food product makers prevailed, we had about 130 different small businesses registered in the kitchens, which, yeah. So some of them, you know, were only using the kitchens for a couple of hours to jar some chili jam, you know, a month, that kind of thing. But we had 130, and that really put us up in like one of the most populated shared kitchen facilities in the world. And it was a logistics nightmare, but it was very active, you know, it was very lively, and that made a nice backdrop for events as well. But again, didn't make enough money. So we started to carve out parts of the day, you know, the dinner shifts, the dinner times, and we cut holes in our kitchen so that they had frontages to our event space. And we started to hand pick food makers that actually wanted to start restaurants rather than products. And they started to provide a hawker style food service for us at that point.
I know a lot has changed since then as well, which we'll get into. But you mentioned that you gave away your cooking for this idea. Take us back to when you were young. What sort of role did food play for you when you were young?
I think food's always been an obsession in my family. So my dad and my mum were both really, really keen on eating out, and would take us to beautiful restaurants from a very young age. And I was just an eater. I just absolutely loved to eat anything. And they were also cookbook fiends. So I would take cookbook and food book fiends. I would take cookbooks to bed, you know, and read them as a kid. I think Harold McGee's on The Science and Law of Food and Cooking, is it? That was one of like my first bedtime books. I'd take it to bed and read about eggs and all the ways that they work in cooking. And Marco Pierre White's White Heat was one of the first books that I devoured. So cookbooks was something that I coveted from my parents, and then, you know, would read them like novels. And I'd go to any cooking class that would come to Brisbane. You know, Christine Manfield was one of the first chefs that I saw, and I just thought she was amazing. She was so amazing. I still love her book from that time, Spice, with its like 150 ingredients for one dish style. So yeah, so I was obsessed. And then I stayed kind of obsessed with it in a restaurant sense through high school. I never really considered it beyond something that I enjoyed at that stage. But once I left home and started cooking for myself, I focused on like just loving food from a cookbook angle, and from going to gorgeous restaurants. And from there, you know, I went to uni, and I was kind of following a path that I felt like I had to follow. You know, I had to do, you know, what people that do well at school do is go to uni and find a career. But really, my passion was still in food, and it was this thing always tapping my shoulder, saying, how do we find a way in, Ange? How do we find this food? How do we get this food into this life that you're creating? So I finished an honours degree at uni, and I immediately went and approached Leanne Newmans from the Green Papaya for work. And I started an apprenticeship with her, and she was my first strong female teacher in food And I that wasn't my mum. And I just kept seeking them out. It was the women in food that really, that I was attracted to working for. And I think it was, you know, what they were like as leaders and bosses, but also, you know, just wondering how it is that they run kitchens and how they make it all work. So she was my first, and then I went back to uni, and I just vacillated in and out of and working in kitchens, and then coming back and thinking about food in a scholarly way. So I basically did that through my 20s, gaining a little bit of experience here and there, but also just filling myself up on cooking projects and reading projects and developing a insane cookbook library, which is like an index to my brain.
When did the real connection that is a real driving force for you to sort of ethical producers and farmers become really important in the overall picture for you?
I think it was something that I started to become cognizant of when I was studying architecture, and I remember going to a sustainability conference at the Gold Coast and hearing Robin Francis speak about this thing called permaculture, and she was so inspiring, and I had never heard of anything like this thing, and it sounded like architecture, but like it's, you know, it's arch nemesis. It was messy and evolving, and it was this beautiful design concept. And I remember at the end of her talking about permaculture, I went up to her and said, I just want to do what you do. How do I do what you do? Because architecture wasn't really making sense to me. And she said, well, you just come and do a permaculture certificate with me. So I went and did that and immersed myself in the beautiful messiness that is edible landscape design. And from there, it started to materialize this sense that, you know, everywhere I looked in cities, I'd see ornamentation and an aesthetics built out of uselessness. And I just didn't get it. And I wondered where all the food was. You know, where is all the food? And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that, you know, our food production systems were broken, and they were so broken that we'd hide them, you know, from so no one could see them, and keep them far away from any kind of entanglement with people's sense of what's right, you know, what's right in their lives. And I just wanted to think more about that and have an impact on that thinking. So I focused on looking at permaculture first and seeing whether, you know, the way that it thinks about design could have a positive impact on architecture and the way it's taught at universities. So that was my first research project. And then after that, and after some, you know, cooking in restaurants, I came back and started a PhD, which initially, you know, I just kept in architecture and thought it would be a continuation of that, like thinking about food production in cities and how it works, and just realized that I, you know, that my mind did not work like architectural theorists, and that I needed to find my kin. And so I spent a year like just moving around the university, and I went to sociology and urban anthropology and all sorts of different departments, and trying to find someone who could make sense to my brain. And I eventually found this wonderful philosopher called Michelle Boulis Walker, who's actually coming to dinner here on Thursday night, yeah. And she just introduced me to continental philosophy and a particular ethicist and his writing, and just said to me, you know, I think he might make sense to you, so why don't you just read him for 6 months? Imagine someone telling you that. Just read this person for 6 months. Just read them for 6 months. See how you go. See what you think. So I did. And I just loved what he was. It just blew my mind. And I I just realized that I wanted to think at that level, you know, at this philosophical level about food. Yeah. So did that. Do you want me to keep going?
The Wandering Cooks is not the same as it used to be, and it's also moved. Tell us about the move and what it's transitioned into.
So the move was imminent because we received our before COVID hit, not long before COVID hit, we'd received our notice to leave. So someone had bought the site we were on, and we had 2 years to vacate, basically. So we knew we needed to go. And at the same time, we'd reached a level of confidence in what we were doing and the way that people were embracing our space, that we were able to make quite a blunt and not very popular decision with a lot of our food makers to become more hard-lined about their sourcing. So it was one of these things that we attempted to do so many times over the years to get people to only purchase their ingredients from what we would, you know, what I can shorthand say from ethical sources. But it was never easy, and we never had the right kind of conditions to be able to make that work. And, you know, we were scared that we just wouldn't have anyone serving any food if we were, you know, too hardcore about it. So we never celebrated that part of the business specifically, because I just didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to be a greenwashing business. I didn't want to pretend that we were achieving something when half of our businesses or three quarters of our businesses weren't, right? So we got to a point just before COVID hit that we'd said, okay, enough's enough. We got to do it. You know, we've got a list of these incredible farmers that we want to work with. From 6 months' time, if you guys haven't come on board with working with these farmers, then if you haven't agreed to that, and we'll work through the issues with it, we'll work through the problems. But if you don't agree to that being the problem of this place, then you got to head out on your own. You got to find your new accommodations. So it was, you know, some people were like, yeah, sure, whatever, like, of course. And then a lot of people were really, really angry at us. So we were dealing with that at the time, and we'd started what we called the ingredient challenge, which was this attempt to bring in people that were already wanting to source the way we were interested in sourcing. And we had a series of chefs that were helping us workshop with them and help them work through the problems of sourcing from small ethical farmers. You know, how do you deal with the vagaries of their, you know, with their supply, and how do you keep your menu flexible enough, and how do you cost it appropriately, and all of that stuff. So we just done that. We just had gone through our first crew of intake from that, and then COVID hit. And so we really hadn't been able to set up the new system, and we just said goodbye to a whole heap of food makers that had decided not to do the challenge with us. So we were fucked, basically, at that point. And my head imploded, really, and I disappeared in myself for quite a few months. We just closed because there was just no model that would work. We just couldn't operate. So we just closed, and slowly I started to imagine the possibilities out of that. And the first steps out of it were not where we are now. There were still other people cooking in the kitchens, and other people, but what we did decide is that we would just take it on. We would take on the kitchen ourselves. It was a huge relief because I knew then I didn't have to force anyone to do the kind of sourcing that I wanted us to do, that I could just make that choice myself and do it. So that was great. And so we started up slowly and surely. That was the first year of COVID. We at the end of the year, we started opening one night a week, and we started this beautiful market on a Saturday morning that showcased all of the farmers that we wanted to work with, that we were working with. So we had this beautiful produce market that was like a farm gate. So it was us buying the produce in and selling it like a pop-up sort of grocery store on a Saturday morning. And it was all kind of, you know, it was still a little crazy, but it was starting to show legs. And then, the chef that I'd employed to do it left, and I was just thrown back in the kitchen. Like there was just no choice. Like I had no chef, and I just had to step back in. And, it's funny that I just had lost my confidence to actually do that. I hadn't even considered it really, that it could be me, you know? And then it had to be me. And I stepped back into the kitchen and it's like from the moment that I did it, I just knew I didn't want to do anything else. I was like, holy shit, how have I been away from this for so long? Really, how long, how have I been away from this for so long? This is like this, I just felt like a different person. I felt completely myself again for the first time in 12, 15 years.
Tell us about how you feel when you cook and a bit about your cooking.
I feel completely in the flow when I'm in the kitchen, particularly when I don't have too much pressure to get out of the kitchen, or I've got a bit of space. You know, one of those days where you might, it's crazy, but if you're overworking, you know, you're not just there for service, but you're, you know, coming in on your days off. Those are actually the days where I feel truly myself. I go into the kitchen and I'm faced with a mountain of produce to deal with, because we still run the farm gate on a Saturday. I still get in a whole lot of produce. I try to take different things from different farmers so that everyone like has some stuff coming in. And then you never really know what's going to sell at the farm gate. Sometimes, you know, all the broad beans go, and sometimes, you know, half of them go. And so I'm faced by a mountain of produce on a day like this. And I kind of just start somewhere. I just like dig in. I just pull out, you know, something. And the thing that I pull out, as long as I've got like quiet around me, then I start to imagine where it could head, and the lines and the connections web together in my mind, and I can start to taste what it wants to be. It's the same thing that used to happen to me. I worked at the Rose Bakery in Paris for a while, and it was my job to make the daily special. And it's the same thing. I would get this thing that would happen where I'd start with whatever ingredient, you know, we'd brought in. Say it was an organic chicken, and I knew that we also had za'atar in, you know, fresh za'atar or something like that. And then I would start to I could actually imagine myself on a Mediterranean mountain edge, a cliff. And I've never even, you know, I haven't been to a place like that, but I could taste the air. I could feel the breeze. I'd start to see where the dish wanted to go. I could tell if it wanted to be quick or slow or contrasty or sharp. I don't know. Does everyone do that? I don't know. The same thing happens when I'm reading cookbooks, is I can get on the same kind of train. Like it starts somewhere, and then I start to see a menu appear. So that's all to say that my menus are very eclectic. They tend to switch around and change with my mood and with what we've got available. So sometimes they seem really quite Southeast Asian focused. You know, there's a lot of heat in it, and sometimes we get a bit of, you know, feedback. It's like, oh, all your dishes are hot. It's like, yeah, I don't know what that is. You know, I don't know why at the moment that's the case. And then, you know, and then something changes, and, you know, we're getting a lot of leeks in, and we're getting broad beans and asparagus, and it just, it's the menu feels, it feels much more smooth and it's, yeah, it's got a very different tempo than it did like a little while ago. So it globetrots, it often changes like from lunch to dinner, because we're just constantly moving through stuff, and sometimes what we're moving through is quite short in supply, so it's just around for a little bit and then shifts on. And I was thinking about this, that, you know, that's not actually that different, I'm sure, to a lot of the way a lot of fine restaurants work, you know, that they're cooking in a similar way. But I think the challenge that I've set for this place is that we want to bring that kind of attention, but it's very middle of the market. You know, like I want it to be a place that people feel like they can come to for dinner all week long if they want. You know, it's not just for special occasions or when you can afford it. It's like when you need nourishment. I want people to come here when they feel like they need to be nourished.
Has this dramatic change in this idea that you came up with many years ago that's changed so much, has it changed you in the last couple of years, this transformation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's made me it's made me clearer about it. It's kind of brought my heart back into the picture. For a long time with cooks, I was very heady, and I was thinking about business a lot and talking to people about a business a lot, and analytical, I suppose, you know, very focused on problem solving, you know, how it was still creative in a way, but a different kind of creativity. And I get a lot of migraines. Like I was constantly getting to myself to this point where I'd have to, you know, at least once or twice a month, just lay up in bed for a day or two, just nursing a brain that had stopped working. And when I stepped back into the kitchen, I was, you know, when I was really kind of pushed back in, I had a headache. And then I just started doing what had to happen, you know, started pulling things together and making things work. And it just disappeared. And I still get occasional tension headaches from like working too hard or having my neck down or, you know, all the things that happen in a kitchen, carrying too heavy a pot. But I don't get migraines. I don't get them anymore. They just stopped. So, yeah, it's changed me in that sense. Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think I could ever be out of the kitchen again. I can't imagine what life would be like out of the kitchen again.
This natural attraction that you've had to the food industry, this inability to pull away from it, has really transformed not just you, but the local community and those people in Brisbane as well. What is it that you're most proud of?
I love it when people come here to this new place that we've created. And it hasn't been here for that long, but they walk in and they say, oh, it just feels right. It feels like it's been here. It feels old. It feels like, you know, it feels like it's landed in the right place. And I love how comfortable people feel at this place, and that they have a natural tendency generally to claim it as their own, you know. I feel that way about my staff and my customers, that I like the idea of being kind of able to step into the shadows and do my work quietly and with observation and with enough of a push at the people around me to just go on and do it the way they feel like they that feels right, and that's, you know, how they come here and use the space, and also how, you know, how my wonderful staff take on their responsibilities and embrace the passions of this place. I feel really proud of that.
Well, Angela, what you've created is absolutely extraordinary, and I know there's so much more we can talk about. So we've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today. Please keep in touch, and we'll definitely have to catch up again soon.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. It's been fun.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au.
Stay safe and be well.